big question as the Fed considers more stimulus. If not now, when?
And why are cars the bright spot for the U.S. economy? Hello, I'm Jeff Horwich in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. It's the Marketplace Midday Update for Wednesday, the first day of August. And coming up, we're also going to look at one of the other effects of the big drought in the Midwest, besides the effect that we've talked about that it's having on farmers. The Mississippi River is drying up a little bit, and it's making shipping a bit more difficult.
We'll talk to the author of a new study who says many of us are way too overconfident. And also check in with I guess we're calling him a nonviolent resistance consultant. He's a Serbian who led the overthrow of Milosevic in 2000. Since then, he's become in demand by protesters in Egypt, Occupy Wall Street, and now in Syria. That and a bunch of other good stuff coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
The Federal Reserve wraps up a two-day meeting today in Washington, and the big question, yet again, will be, is the Fed ready to launch some new economic stimulus in line with its mandate to help the country reach full employment? Julia Coronado is chief economist with the investment bank BNP Paribas, and she's with us now from her office in New York. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, so what do you think? Will the Fed do something? Will they step in to help the economy?
I don't think that they are ready to do anything yet for two reasons. First, I think that they want to gather a little more information, see whether the labor market in particular will do better than expected like it did last year, or whether it will remain weak. If it stays weak, I don't think they will hesitate to act. But the other thing is they want to evaluate their options. What exactly should they do? Should they buy mortgages? Should they buy treasuries? And then maybe in September they'll be ready to take action.
But it's not as if we've had just 1 month of bad job growth. There have been several months of kind of weak job growth. Plus, we had a U.S. growth last quarter at just 1.5%. Consumer spending is down. I mean, what are they waiting for exactly?
Well, that's a great question. And I think, again, you know, we're in this difficult moment where growth is not good enough, but it's not a disaster. So the Fed's trying to figure out whether they still have the power to push the economy to stronger growth, or whether some of these structural issues are just more than they can address. Really, it's a fiscal policy issue more than a monetary policy issue.
Well, if the Fed does decide to wait until their next meeting in September, you know, last I checked, we're going to be 2 months away from a big election, and I assume the Fed's not going to want to insert itself into the politics going on at that point.
You know, Chairman Bernanke was asked that very question when he testified before Congress, and he said rather defiantly, we will take the actions that we think are necessary for the economy, regardless of the election cycle. And they have done that in the past. So I think if the Fed's judgment is that the economy is too weak and they need to take action, they will do it even if we're just 2 months ahead of an election.
Julia Coronado, chief economist with the investment bank BNP Paribas, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure.
So as we're speaking at the moment, the U.S. market's been pretty quiet so far this morning. In Europe, markets closed mixed. And in Asia, stocks in Japan ended 4 days of gains. The Nikkei index fell today by 0.6%. One factor there was a new report showing slower manufacturing growth in China. And that signals lower consumer demand in what is Japan's main export market.
Here in this country, the payroll processing company ADP says 163,000 private sector jobs were created last month in the United States. That was below expectations. And it comes, of course, ahead of the big jobs report from the Labor Department, which is coming up on Friday. Also, earnings beat expectations at Comcast, which owns NBC Universal. They had a big film flop called Battleship, and ad revenues were down at NBC. But they added lots more internet and telephone subscribers.
Burger King said this morning its profits were up 60% last quarter, and that's after they made their menu a little less Whopper-centric. They added fruit smoothies, salads, bacon ice cream sundaes, remember hearing about that, and barbecue sandwiches. Chrysler had its best July U.S. sales in 5 years. Lots more people were buying Ram pickups, and they chalk that up to more home-building activity. Volkswagen and Nissan also reporting strong sales numbers this morning. Ford, on the other hand, sales were down a bit in July, and GM numbers we should see very shortly. Earnings for that company are out tomorrow. For some insight into the car market, Carl Brower is here. He's editor-in-chief of the website TotalCarScore.com. Good to talk with you.
Hey, great talking with you.
So we watch this stream of numbers every day giving us the vital signs of the U.S. economy. Lately, the auto sector seems just a little bit brighter than the others. What's going on?
It is brighter, and I think it's brighter because there have been so many people driving so many of the same car for 10 plus years that they're ready for a replacement. I mean, the average car age right now is somewhere around 11 years old, which is a historic high. So people are ready to get out of their cars, even with some economic concerns, you know, looming above them.
Are there particular cars that are getting them excited to try something new?
I think there are. This is a hot year for cars, and not in the sense of really cool, sexy cars necessarily, but really just important cars. You're going to see all new vehicles in 2013, like the Chevy Malibu, the Honda Accord, the Ford Fusion, the Nissan Altima. And when you have this many all new high volume cars coming in a short time period, that alone is going to stimulate sales.
As you said, that doesn't sound very exciting,
right?
These particular cars, but I gather they're just really the bread and butter of automakers everywhere, huh?
Exactly. With them making up such a large percentage of total new car sales, you know, any one of these models is going to spur a certain amount of activity.
In terms of the corporate bottom line, though, all or most of these car companies are really international organizations. And as we saw with Ford the other day, Europe is extremely important for many of them. Isn't that a worry?
It is a worry, and this is the kind of double-edged sword. Everyone thinks a global market and competing on a global scale is always the way you want to go. It's one of the reasons Chrysler actually is showing, you know, some strong growth this year, because they aren't as dependent on Europe as Ford and GM. Ironically, of course, Chrysler's parent company, Fiat, is based in Europe, and they're suffering along with everyone else over there. And now Sergio Marchionne is having to focus more on the domestic production here in this country because that's where it's strong, and he's having to cut back in Europe.
Carl Brower with TotalCarScore.com. Thanks.
Thanks for talking to me.
The presumptive Republican presidential nominee Mitt Romney said recently, "We have to have taxes that are competitive with other nations." Politicians, Jeremy, frequently make this connection between tax rates and economic growth. We hear
right.
that all the time. Growth, of course, something the American economy badly needs. But if we look at evidence around the world, how strong is that link between lower taxes and higher growth? We asked Marketplace's Stephen Beard to check into it.
Sweden taxes its citizens more heavily than any other country. The personal tax burden is about twice that in the U.S. There is an upside. Swedes don't have to worry about high-quality health care and education. Both are provided by the state. But there's a downside too, says Pierre LeBlanc, a tax expert with the OECD in Paris.
Countries raising a higher share of their revenues through personal income taxes and Social Security contributions tend to have, on average, lower rates of economic growth.
Take Denmark, another very high tax country. In the first decade of this century, the Danish economy grew by only 4.5% over that entire period. Low taxes, on the other hand, seem to have the opposite effect. Matthew Sinclair of the UK's Taxpayers Alliance.
Lower taxes, there's a very, very strong academic literature, official literature, showing that they are associated with higher economic growth.
Look at Australia and New Zealand. Personal taxes there are lower than in the US, and economic growth has been significantly higher. But John Christensen, who campaigns against tax evasion, is not persuaded.
There isn't a clear pattern as such.
He says there are too many exceptions. Low-tax Portugal with its abysmal growth record. And what about the US, a relatively low-tax country which between 2000 and 2010 actually underperformed Sweden?
So there's no evidence that high taxes slow down rates of growth or that low taxes stimulate higher rates of growth.
Opinions are divided on this issue, but John Whiting of the Institute of Taxation says one thing is certain. High rates of personal tax can drive rich and talented individuals away.
If you do pluck too many feathers from the goose, it may waddle off and lay its golden eggs somewhere else.
In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
So, Jeff, when you do a really good job, I'm sure that some people come up to you and say, great job, Jeff. That was excellent.
Yes, every now and then.
Every
I
now
earn
and
some
again.
Plaudits.
But when you don't do that great of a job, you probably don't hear from the people who think, that wasn't so great. And that is mm-hmm. part of the problem, according to a new study that says we're getting a little overconfident. It's called Polite But Not Honest, How an Absence of Negative Social Feedback Contributes to Overconfidence.
Hmm. Well, for today's Midday Extra, we have the author of that study, Joyce Erlinger. She's an assistant professor of psychology at Florida State University in Tallahassee. Hi, Joyce.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thanks. So tell me what we're talking about here. I mean, is there a critical difference between confidence and overconfidence? How do you define that?
Yeah, there absolutely is. In a series of studies by myself and other people, what we do is we compare what people think about their abilities or their skills, and we compare those to objective measures of those skills. So, for example, if you look at doctors' perceptions of their abilities and then compare that to tests of what they know, doctors tend to be overconfident. If you look at lawyers' perceptions of how likely they are to win a particular case, those tend to not map on to whether or not they actually are going to win that case. The perceptions that employees have about their abilities don't necessarily map on to those that their managers have. So there seems to really be, for many, many domains, a tendency for people to be overconfident. One reason for that is that people are very, very reticent to offer negative feedback. We don't like to offer negative feedback. We avoid it when possible, and you could avoid it through trying to find some positive twist on that negative feedback. So maybe you would say, you know, maybe that wasn't the best radio show, but I really liked that 2 minutes when you talked about this. You know, just focus on that positive amount. Or maybe if it's a really, really bad show, you just duck into your office and try to avoid talking to the person until
I've noticed now is that when you get feedback, especially from a manager, they always like to put something nice first, and then they put the bad thing in the middle, and then they end it with something nice, I guess,
yeah,
to hide what they're doing.
They try to minimize that negative feedback as much as possible, or sometimes they'll delegate the giving of negative feedback. So they'll tell you the nice feedback, and they'll make sure that the next person down the line has to tell you, oh, by the way, you're messing up in all these different ways. And finding that, yeah, absolutely, when you're not getting the full message, you're not really hearing that you haven't done well, then you end up feeling just great about how well you did, even if really you did not do well at all.
Now, there are reasons that you might justify our behavior in this regard. Employee morale, for example, not wanting to crush people's spirit is one. But when is overconfidence truly harmful in the workplace?
Overconfidence is fine when it isn't for something that's really important. But let's say that you're working on an important project and you're not getting the feedback that you need to change the direction you're taking, or you're not getting the feedback that really this is a project that maybe isn't one that should continue. Maybe you're just throwing bad money after good. Then there's a real problem. Then you need to hear that you're really needing to change your direction.
How about you, Joyce? Are you done patronizing the people around you? And are you bearing up for whatever people honestly throw your way?
Yes and no. I'm a little bit afraid that by doing this research, I'm going to hear, you know, how bad I really look in that dress, all of the messages I don't really need to know. But I do want to be better. I want to have my research be as strong as it could possibly be. I want to hear the feedback that is both positive and negative. And so sometimes I'll ask people, I'll say, I really want to improve this. I want to hear good and the bad. And that might give people a little bit more license to tell me their true opinion. Probably I'll still get that positive feedback and then the negative and then the positive feedback at the end. But at least that way I'll be more likely to get the negative feedback that I need to really improve.
Well, Joyce Erlinger, thank you so much. That was just an incredibly interesting interview. It was the greatest thing we've ever had on the show. Thank you.
Scintillating.
And I believe that 100%.
No, really, it was great. Thank you very
much.
All
right, thanks.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
The power is coming back on this morning in India after yesterday's huge blackout that left more than 600 million people in the dark. It was the second outage in 2 days, and it's blamed in part on the rising demand for electricity. It's one of the world's fastest growing economies, after all.
But in another one of the world's fastest growing economies, that would be China, a blackout like this would be unthinkable. Marketplace's China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz explains why.
If, and that's a very big if, half of China suddenly lost power, what would happen to the official in charge of the national power grid? Sean Ryan, author of The End of Cheap China and head of China Market Research, has a guess.
He probably would be arrested and put under investigation for corruption and might be demoted at the very least within the party.
In India, on the other hand, the prime minister rewarded the head of the country's crippled power grid with a promotion. On paper, the demographics of India and China may look the same, but not on the ground.
Part of the issue is that Chinese are not willing to accept problems with infrastructure. You know, they're much more likely to protest than many Indians would. I think Indians are more used to many of the brownouts because they happen on an ongoing, regular basis anyway.
More and more companies are looking beyond India when it comes to where they want to build their next factory. Both India and China are relatively poor countries with long traditions of corruption. But, says Ryan, China's Communist Party lives in constant fear that if it doesn't please the people will revolt. In democratic India, people can vent with a vote. Problem is, almost always, the new boss is the same as the old boss. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
The military fight for Syria is expanding in the country's largest city, Aleppo. Reports just out this morning say clashes have also kicked up again in the capital, Damascus. Now, the battle for Syria is not just for control of the country. There is also a battle within the resistance over how that victory should be achieved. Like the people of other Arab Spring nations before them, Syrians are looking abroad for answers.
One person that they're turning to is Serge Popovic. He led the overthrow of Slobodan Milosevic in Serbia in 2000. And since then, he's become essentially kind of a nonviolent resistance consultant. That's our term, not his, but it fits. His nonprofit, the Center for Applied Nonviolent Action and Strategies, has worked with people in Egypt, the Occupy Wall Street movement. And now, though he doesn't want to name his contacts for obvious reasons, he's doing some work with folks in Syria. Serge Popovic is with us from Belgrade. Great to talk with you.
Great to talk to you, too.
You always acknowledge your debt to Gandhi, Martin Luther King. But how have you had to update the skills and the techniques of the people who came before you?
Well, Gandhi and Martin Luther King are the great inspiration, but the nonviolent struggle is an everlasting process. And one of the things we do by sharing knowledge and skills with activists throughout the world is that we also learn. So every single individual struggle brings something new, whether this is the humor or various technology advantage, which you have seen all over the Arab Spring. So we doing it by constantly learning.
You offered your insights to some parts of the Occupy movement here in the U.S. Do you have an economic message?
Well, I mean, whether we are talking about the economic or the democratic struggle, basics of these struggles are all the same because they have awakened the activism in the countries where activism was really, really dormant for a number of years, and they really came out with the right issue. Unequal distribution of the capital, which hits most of the countries in the world, and I'm not talking only about the countries of liberal capitalism here. I mean, look at the dictatorships in places like Syria. The wealth is even more concentrated. We are talking about only few families, not few percents. But this is the message of social justice, which really appeals to everybody.
Looking at Syria and also maybe Libya, I see sort of a new progression that you're probably not so happy with, where perhaps your ideas bring the tension to a head, force the dictatorial regime into an untenable position, and then violence finishes the process. Are you worried about that?
That's the worst case scenario. And I mean, if you look at the history of the violent and nonviolent struggle in the last 106 years, there are very, very slim chances that if you win through the violent struggle, you will end up in democracy. What really makes me disturbed is that the people around the globe, and especially the journalists, they don't draw this line. And they just look at these things and they look at the bad guy and say, okay, Gaddafi is down. But the thing is, what next? And I mean, if there was not a popular movement with a clear political alternative, these countries could easily slip in chaos.
Serge Popovic, now most associated with the Center for Applied Nonviolent Action and Strategies, with me from Serbia. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
So, Jeremy, the chiefs of air defense and border security have just been fired in Belarus over a peaceful protest there. Belarus is this authoritarian former Soviet country in Eastern Europe. Right. And the official's offense was failing to stop an invasion of teddy bears. There was an airdrop a little while ago of 800 teddy bears dropped from a plane that was orchestrated out of Sweden. And each of these little bears carried a message calling for Belarus to show greater respect for human rights. Pulling this off, of course, involved violating Belarusian airspace. I guess if you have to do that, there's no more warm and fuzzy way than a teddy bear.
Well, it's not warm and fuzzy teddy bears that are raining in St. Louis. In fact, nothing is raining in St. Louis. It's been very hot and dry for a while. It's going to be extremely hot and sunny for the next 10 days at least, according to the forecast, which is, of course, not great news for the region that is in the midst of the worst drought in decades. Now, Jeff, we've heard about the effect that the drought is having on farmers, but it turns out it's also shrinking the shipping lanes in the Mississippi River. Adam Allington of St. Louis Public Radio has the story.
Standing on a river barge south of St. Louis, you can't help but notice that the mighty Mississippi just isn't that mighty right now. In fact, it's about 13 feet below normal.
Right now, you can see 30 feet of sand that you shouldn't be able to see.
Butler Miller is the president of barge operator Robert Miller and Associates. He says the drought of 2012 has put a huge squeeze on his biggest customers, grain and food producers who ship products down to New Orleans for export.
We have 60 to 70% of our equipment idle, just waiting for work. Harvest is due to start in the southern United States maybe in the next 2 weeks. Hopefully we can get some more barges loaded then. But, you know, we've had this level of being idle for the last 2 to 3 months.
On top of that, Miller says traffic on the river is restricted to one lane in some areas, and barges can't be filled to their full capacity.
You would like to load a barge 2,200 tons. With these new draft restrictions, it's maybe more like 1,600 tons, you know. Profits are greatly strained.
Don Sweeney is the associate director of the Center for Transportation Studies at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. While barge traffic only accounts for a tiny fraction of the transportation economy, he says its cargo finds its way into lots of industries.
It's roughly, you know, a $7 to $10 billion industry nationwide. And, you know, in a $14 trillion economy, that's not a big deal. But it is a big deal in the sense that it moves some of the more basic products across the nation.
Sweeney says reduced traffic on the river will likely increase prices on certain raw commodities, such as corn, soybeans, petroleum, and coal. In St. Louis, I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
And speaking of shipping traffic, the government of Nicaragua is paying two Dutch companies about $750,000 to study the feasibility of building a canal. Now, there's already a canal in that area of the world. This new one would rival the Panama Canal and create another link from the Pacific Ocean to the Caribbean Sea.
Richard Mead is editor of the shipping industry publication Lloyd's List, and he joins us now to discuss. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, so how does the shipping industry feel about this idea of building a new canal that would go through Nicaragua and Costa Rica?
Well, I think the thing to remember is that this is a perennial story for the shipping industry. I mean, the idea of a Nicaragua canal has been floating around since the 16th century. So I don't think anyone's necessarily holding their breath. But, I mean, broadly speaking, I think the shipping industry would welcome it. It would certainly supply a sort of a level of competition for global trade and a certain effervescence of vying between the two South American states for transporting shipping that just doesn't exist at the moment.
Well, which ships would decide to use that canal as opposed to the Panama Canal, do you think?
Well, as far as I understand it, the Nicaragua Canal is planning to sort of outbid the Panama Canal in terms of size. Now, the Nicaragua Canal, if the plans ever came to fruition, you would be able to take certainly some of the largest ships, but certainly not the largest ships. You wouldn't be able to get, for example, a very large crude carrier, which is the biggest large oil tanker in existence.
All right. So you say this has been talked about since the 1600s. What do you think? You think it'll happen this time? I mean, they've hired these Dutch companies to look into it.
Realistically, I doubt the economics are going to add up. I think you need to look more widely at the global economic trends in terms of shipping. I mean, we're seeing an increase in terms of the size of the ships, but simultaneously you're also seeing a massive increase in terms of the price of fuel that powers these ships. And if you're looking at a global trade infrastructure that is more based in terms of reliability than in terms of speed, it's really just a question of how much it's going to cost to get goods from A to B. I don't necessarily see the shortcut of a Nicaragua canal being that much of a swing in terms of that decision.
Richard Mead, editor of the shipping industry publication Lloyd's List. Thanks so much.
That's quite all right. Thank you.
Well, say goodbye to Hotmail, Jeff. Hotmail.com is being rebranded as of today. Microsoft is changing it to Outlook.com, of course, after its popular email program, Outlook, which I guess is more popular than the free email service Hotmail. It's been around for 16 years.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, of course, to compete better with Yahoo and Gmail. Marketplace's Amy Scott has our story about that.
Hotmail is still the largest provider of online email, with more than 300 million users worldwide. But in the coolness department, it's maybe a step up from AOL.
I think a rebranding was in order.
That's analyst Phil Karcher with Forrester Research. The new name, Outlook, is familiar to users of Microsoft's Office suite of software.
It's a different name to go with a new, more streamlined user experience. It has social integration with Twitter and Facebook. It's a very different experience from the original Hotmail.
Karcher says the move is also meant to head off Google's recent inroads into the corporate email market. And unlike Google's Gmail, the new Outlook won't tailor its advertising based on the content of your messages. Just the subject lines. Hotmail users will be switched over to Outlook.com in the next few months, and they'll get to keep their usernames. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Well, I'm going to have to get on there, Jeff, and check out the new Outlook.com as soon as I can remember what my Hotmail password is.
Do you have a Hotmail password still?
I do. And you know, I use Hotmail typically for people that I don't want to email me. I
yeah.
I use my Hotmail account if I'm signing up for something or whatever. So it's just all junk mail. And yeah, I guess maybe I'll have to rethink it.
I might have one buried back deep in my memory along with my, like, Excite.com email.
Alta Vista. Yeah, exactly.
Somewhere in there. In Los Angeles. I'm Jeff Horwich.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.